You're listening to the North Canton Chapel podcast. Thank you for joining us today. The North Canton Chapel exists to make much of Jesus every day to everyone. It's our prayer that this podcast will equip you to do just that. We believe that there's nothing like the church united together in gospel community. We'd love if you'd stop in and say hello in person if you're in our neighborhood. Our gathering times are at 9 and 10:30 a.m. Thank you again for joining us today. Let's listen in.
So justice is a pretty loaded word these days. We're told that God is a God of justice. He invites us to work toward justice. We're called to respond when we see injustice. But it's not so easy to define what justice is it? How is justice different from revenge? Is mercy the opposite of justice? And what in the world is with that whole turn the other cheek business? Welcome to week two of this four-week series called Wilderness Stories. And this week we're following a young man as he wanders through the wilderness of injustice. And as he does, he finds that God's justice is often more beautiful and more complicated than he might have imagined. And so if you've ever wondered, is God just, or what does his justice look like? I'm really glad you're here. His story starts in Genesis chapter 37, and so without delay, if you want to turn there, flip there, scroll there, or if you don't have anything with you, that's okay. Everything you need will be on the screen behind me in just a few moments. But as you're getting to Genesis 37, just let's get our bearings a bit. Last week, we left off with a young girl named Hagar as she wandered through the wilderness of rejection. And she heads back home, and things go, well, like not so great. Those angelic words about her bucking bronco of a boy named Ishmael, turns out those words are true. He grows up and picks on his younger half-brother, Isaac, and Abraham kicks them out again. Ishmael's story doesn't end there, but the focus kind of shifts to Isaac. Isaac's grandsons become the 12 tribes of Israel, and one of those sons gets a little more press than the rest of them, one named Joseph. 30% of Genesis is devoted to the Joseph narrative. That's a lot of ancient ink. Last bit of intro. What is justice biblically? Let me give you just a working definition. One word. Justice is oughtness. Oughtness. The way things ought to be. And for now, all of us live in an unjust world where unoughtness seems to be the order of the day. We grieve what is, but we can't shake the feeling for what should be. Oughtness. Joseph experiences unoughtness spread over five acts. There's a lot of sand to trudge through with Joseph. And that brings us to Genesis 37. The curtain opens on a fairly complicated family situation where we immediately get the sense that the family tensions of past generations haven't dissipated. If anything, they're just slowly simmering on the back burner. Here's the scene, Genesis chapter 37, verse 1. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Ruh-roh. Now Israel, that is Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when the brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers, they hated him, and they could not speak peacefully to him. Again, you feel the mood at the beginning of verse 4, don't you? It starts to get worse, though. Verse 5, now Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And he said to them, here's the dream. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. His brothers said to him, are you indeed to reign over us, or are you indeed to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. It's not enough that dad buys little pretty boy a new car, strike one. Now we're all going to work for him, strike two. Gets even worse. Look in verse 9. He dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, behold, I've dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. And when he told it to his father and his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow down ourselves in the ground before you? And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in his mind, and strike three. Now, I'm not taking the brother's side on this, but let's put this in context. Joseph is 17 years old. He's got 10 older brothers. Safe to assume they're anywhere from 19 to like mid-30s. So here's junior varsity, still wet behind the ears, high school sophomore, telling his adult brothers that they're going to be working for him before too long. And the text just kind of leaves the mood there. Tolerable, but tense. And you know what happens, don't you? Because bitterness festers. Jealousy left alone never gets better. And so the story continues with a slight relocation. The brothers are pastoring their father's flocks about 60 miles away in a town called Shechem. And then they move 10 more miles to another town called Dothan, 70 miles away from home. That's like from here to Pittsburgh. Just far enough. So Jacob calls Joseph. Slide down to verse 14. He said to him, go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word. He sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Slide down to verse 18. They saw him coming from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let's kill him and throw him in one of the pits, and we'll say a fierce animal has devoured him. And we'll see what becomes of his dreams. Slide down to verse 23. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore. They took him, threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Don't miss that last detail. No water. What does that mean? He's as good as dead. Then the plan gets twisted. Go down to verse 25. Then they sat down to eat. They sat down to eat? Like, did they hear him? Like, they're there munching. He's over here screaming. Like, that's sociopathic. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites. Oh, they're second cousins. Coming down from Gilead with their camels bearing gum and balm and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. And Joseph said to his brother, or Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and let not our hand be upon him, for he's our brother, our own flesh. His brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by. They drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Slide down a couple more verses and we'll put the last stroke on this scene. Verse 31. He took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, this we found. Please identify whether it's your son's robe or not. They FedEx Joseph's robe back home. They can't even be bothered to take it themselves. And 70 miles away, 10 sons are content to hear their dad linger in his only conclusion. Verse 34, Jacob tore his garments, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned his son for many days. Jealousy rises in the human heart like a dull blade, silent, hard, and destructive, a self-administered prison sentence that grows around you like a cage. And that's injustice number one, betrayal. Betrayal in any form hurts, I think, but family betrayal cuts deepest. Why? Because family is supposed to be this place of safety and nurturing, right? Family is supposed to be the place where you learn who you are and how you're oriented around the world around you. But for Joseph, family has become this angry, betraying, ugly thing. And some of you know what that feels like. Hopefully not many of you, but in a room this size or those watching online, some of you know what family betrayal feels like. And God's silence in the face of familial violence, like, ugh, like, where is he? Good question. We don't have an answer for that yet. It'll come, not for a little while. Here's Act 2. Join me in chapter 39. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. He was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. And so Joseph found favor in the sight and attended him. Made him an overseer of his house, put him in charge of all that he had. And from the time he made him an overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. And because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food that he ate. Now, this sounds great, doesn't it? Because this sense of oughtness that we talked about earlier seems like God, despite the intention of his brothers, has kind of set Joseph's life back right. Joseph's wilderness wanderings seem to be just a passing season, a quick stopover. However, now, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Stop. Don't you love how Scripture just kind of tells us what's about to happen? That's not a small detail. It sets the stage for this whole debacle. He was handsome in form and appearance, and after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house. He's put everything that he has in my charge. He's not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept anything back from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Now, this is more than a little bit creepy. And what is with all these Old Testament people and like their constant need to like, you know, Genesis is not a PG movie, okay? So venture in gently, kids. But did you catch what Joseph said? Why does he reject her offer? What's his concern? He starts by professing loyalty to his boss, her husband, but then where does his deepest loyalty lie? It's right there at the end of verse 9. He says, "How could I do this great wickedness against what? God." Now, this is not a manual for how to resist sin, but a quick instructive point while we're pulled off for a bit. Sin is at its most repulsive when we see it not as a horizontal problem to resist, but as a vertical covenant to preserve. Don't resist sin because you don't want to get caught. Resist sin because you love God. Whatever sin you're fighting right now, this morning, it's about you and God and your relationship. Now, here's how we would love this story to go. We would love it if Potiphar's wife goes like, oh, Joseph, I had no idea that your God meant so much to you. I had no idea that, gosh, I really admire your faith. What must I do to bring my life into greater alignment with your God? We would love it if it was a conversion story, but how does it go? Verse 10, she spoke to Joseph day after day. He would not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. One day, when he went into the house to do his work, none of the men of the house were in the house. She caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. Holy smokes, lady. He left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand, she fled out of the house. She called the men of her household and said to them, see, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to lie with me and cried out, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as I heard that, I lifted up my voice and cried out. He left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house. And she laid up his garment by her until his master came home. And she told the same story, saying, the Hebrew servant who you brought among us came in to me to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house. She flips the script. And it's her word against his. And who does the master believe? Answer, verse 19. As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, this is the way your servant treated me. His anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in prison. Okay. This is injustice number two. False accusation. And you caught the connecting thread, I hope, pun intended, in both Act 1 and Act 2. Joseph's cloak is presented as evidence that results in imprisonment. And I'd love to believe that Joseph went to jail compliantly. The text gives us no reason to suggest otherwise. But he's also human. And false accusation has a way of messing with you a little bit, doesn't it? But don't miss that next verse. Look at verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love, as if to say, don't fall into the trap of thinking that God's not here. God will restore oughtness, maybe not as quickly as we would like, whether physical or spiritual. There's no prison too deep where God cannot be. Don't think that God's hand can't hold betrayal and false accusation and unjust imprisonment, which makes me go, sometimes God saves us from pain. More often, he saves us through pain. And I don't like that, because that is a very hard gospel to preach. But that certainly seems to be in his toolbox. Now, Act 3. Joseph lands in prison. There's two guys with him, Pharaoh's personal chef and his personal cupbearer. These guys know Pharaoh, maybe in the way that not a lot of other people do. Think about them like a barber and a bartender. They just know stuff because of what they do. And each one of these guys has a dream while they're in prison. The creepy sort of dreams that kind of mess with you a little bit. And Joseph notices, and he asks them about it. Here's the situation, chapter 40, verse 8. They said to him, we've had dreams, and there's no one to interpret them. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me. So they tell their dreams to Joseph. Joseph interprets them. Basically this, cupbearer. Pharaoh's going to give you your job back. He's going to raise you back up. You, not so much. In fact, you're going to die here and pretty soon. And so Joseph, having interpreted the dreams, turned to Pharaoh's cupbearer and really asks only one thing. Verse 13, in 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me, for when it is well with you, please do me the kindness and mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I've done nothing that they should put me into this pit. And we start to get a sense of Joseph's wrestling a little bit, right? He's a little frustrated. This is him saying, I need to tell you, things ought not to be this way. Get me out of here. What's Joseph asking for? Mindfulness, faithfulness, friendship. Crazy thing. Everything Joseph says happens. One guy gets his job back, the other guy. How do things fare for Joseph? Slide down to verse 23. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. The one guy who could have got him out, just slipped his mind. And the reverberation of neglect continues to sound in the depths of Joseph's saddening soul. And this is injustice number three, being forgotten. You ever feel like life is happening to everybody around you but you? Unfriended, unchosen, unseen, unremembered. And Joseph never says this, but I would be tempted to say, dude, I did something for you. You couldn't even remember to mention me? You scratch my back, I scratch yours. That's what justice would seem to say. But here Joseph sits, betrayed, falsely accused, completely forgotten. And by the end of chapter 40, you're asking the same question I am. God, where are you? 2 years go by. He sits there for two more years. And Pharaoh can't sleep. Now Pharaoh is having dreams. And they're the creepy kind of dreams that sort of mess with you. Hearing Pharaoh's sovereignly appointed insomnia, his cupbearer's memory sparks. Wait, I know a guy. So he goes to Pharaoh. Here's what he says, chapter 41, verse 12. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. And when we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted to us, so it came about. I was restored to my office, but the baker, well, you know. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I've had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. And I love it. Joseph just deflects. He goes, wait, time out, Pharaoh. We got to get your theology right. If anything's going to happen, it's going to be God, not me. Dude was making much of Jesus before making much of Jesus was cool. And just to quickly summarize, Pharaoh tells Joseph his dream. Joseph interprets the dream for him. Basically this, good news, Pharaoh, you got 7 years of incredible harvest, but then bad news, you got 7 years of terrible famine. And if I were you, I'd save up during the good years to make it through the bad ones. Pharaoh, realizing he's got somebody special in Joseph, goes, okay. You want to help lead it? It's actually better than that. Here's what he actually says. Look at verse 38. Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there's none so discerning and wise as you are, you shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you. Now, before we get to Act 5, let's put the timeline together. Joseph's 17 when his brothers dump him in the pit. And then he ping-pongs from the pit to Potiphar, from Potiphar to prison, from prison to Pharaoh. He's 30 when Pharaoh appoints him to power. You do the math, that's 13 years. If my Bible college math helps me. 13 years of wandering and wandering. 13 years saying half to others, half to himself, I know God's doing something. I know he's working because I know him. Here's the point. Man's injustice cuts deeply, but God's sovereignty is much, much deeper. And that sets the stage for Act 5, because although Joseph is set up pretty well here, we've got this lingering injustice out here in the atmosphere. His brothers. Buckle up, because this is where this gets beautiful. Those 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine that Joseph told his boss about, they happened. And guess whose family doesn't have any food? 10 older brothers, now 25 years older after famine, with families of their own. Now that is a lot of mouths to feed. And so Jacob, their dad, assuming that Joseph is long dead, tells his sons, chapter 42, verse 2, "Behold, I've heard there's grain for sale down in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. Slide down to verse 6. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Well, well, well. How the turning tables have turned. So they come, and Joseph recognizes them. They don't recognize him because it's been 25 stinking years. Joseph loads up their donkeys, blesses them, sends them home. And then another year goes by, chapter 43, verse 2. And when they had eaten the grain that they had brought from Egypt, their father said to him, "Go again, buy us a little bit more food." They come back. Joseph, having sat with this for a whole other year, he has them right where he wants them. He's got all the power, and they have none of it. Justice is about to be served. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, right? You guys ready to see justice done? You ready for the hammer to fall? Slide all the way down to chapter 45, verse 1. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" His brothers couldn't answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near, and he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be dismayed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here." Now wait a minute, watch what he does. "For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, to keep alive for you many survivors. So it wasn't you who sent me here, it was God. And he's made me a father to Pharaoh, lord over his house, ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry, go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come. so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. What in the world is that? One word, mercy. From the wilderness of injustice flows this fountain of forgiveness. The story's not quite done. One more step. His brothers go home, they get dad, pack everything up in the ancient U-Haul, they move down to Egypt, and Jacob dies. Dad's gone, and his brothers can't quite believe that he's forgiven them, and they start to get a little bit nervous. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave the command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because of all the evil they did to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when he spoke to them. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants. And if there's any bitterness left in Joseph's bottle, now is the time to pour it out." Here's Joseph's response, verse 19. "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me. God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Gosh, five quick observations. Am I God? It's not my place. It's not my place. You meant it for evil. He doesn't let him off the hook. He doesn't just roll over and be a doormat. But God. Two most powerful words in Scripture. God is about preserving life, and so don't fear. And then he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Forgiveness disarms and diffuses what wrath wants to warp and ruin. Now, what do we do with all this? The most striking thing to me about this whole story is not just that Joseph survives, but that he's always bringing God up. Did you catch that? When he refuses Potiphar's wife, "How could I sin against God?" When asked to interpret dreams in prison, "Don't interpretations belong to God?" When he accepts Pharaoh's offer, "This isn't me, it's God." And when he finally reconciles with his brothers, "God sent me here, God did this." Here's what that makes me wonder. When I'm in whatever wilderness, for whatever reason, why am I so quick to excuse God? Like, why do I feel the need to be God's lawyer? When the world slaps you in the face, it's one thing to exercise restraint and not slap back. It's another thing entirely to bring blessing for the cursing because we dare to believe that God is actually still at work. Joseph has this wild imagination that says, maybe eye for an eye isn't the fullness of God's purpose. Maybe God doesn't want me to do to them as they deserve. Maybe God has a better way. 1,500 years later, Jesus will say crazy things. Things like this out of Matthew chapter 5. You've heard it said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. I say to you, don't resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them two. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. You've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor, and you should hate your enemy. I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who would persecute you. That sounds absolutely crazy. Come on, Jesus, don't be a sucker. How are you going to get ahead in life that way? How are you going to defeat your enemies that way, Jesus? If I don't serve my enemies justice, who will? Let me venture further into potentially dangerous waters that may draw the ire of some. I wonder if we have forgotten to pray for our enemies because we actually don't love our enemies. I wonder if we have unconsciously bought the narrative that says, kill him before he kills you. I wonder if we stopped believing Jesus when he says, do to others as you would have them do to you. I wonder if our imagination for Christ's kingdom has atrophied from disuse. I wonder if we've lost the taste for mercy because we've lost faith in mercy's restorative power. I wonder if we resist forgiveness because we're afraid to be disarmed by what forgiveness wants to teach us. The wilderness is where God leads us to recover our imagination. Imagination not for things impossible or things fictional or things fanciful or make-believe, but imagination for the real world happening under the world that we observe, the world of oughtness as God intended, in which you necessarily have a part to play, a world where God is silently shifting the sands of our assumptions, confounding our expectations. Could it be that joining Jesus in this crazy love your enemies kingdom means becoming reconciliation makers instead of revenge takers? People who prefer forgiveness over violence, mercy over judgment, people who refuse to join in the death of the world and instead offer the life of God. Can you imagine a world like that? You want to be a part of it? Me too. Now, those are the ethical implications of Joseph's story, and they're very important. But there is something else going on here. Another story silently being set into motion. We're in the last chapter of Genesis. A book whose primary question is, how is God going to fix this? And we're told that there is somebody coming one day who will restore God's oughtness. Genesis shows us how God does what he's going to do. And if you're reading through Genesis and you want to know what the oughtness maker is going to look like, he's going to be someone who will speak blessing over his enemies instead of curses. He'll offer forgiveness for those who don't deserve it. And by his life, he will bring about God's final justice. And as the last stroke of ink dries in the book of Genesis, we catch the hint, this faint foreshadowing in the barely discernible distance, where God takes the greatest evil that man ever intended and turned it into the greatest victory and blessing ever imagined. Where God himself takes the catastrophe of the crucifixion and inverts it into the eucatastrophe of the resurrection, destroying the power of sin and death and restoring the world to its sense of oughtness. Joseph's story whets our appetite for Jesus, who was treated unjustly for crimes he didn't commit, was whipped and spit on, mocked and hung nearly naked in front of a crowd, and in his dying breath still says, Father, forgive them. They don't get it yet. Really, Jesus? What is that about? There's only one way to defeat your enemies, and that is love. This is the story that we all want to be true, and in fact is true, that the creator of everything loves us and forgives us. Here's the gospel. On the cross, Jesus takes justice from my sin so I can experience forgiveness from God. He takes the pain of death and we get the gift of new life. All this from a loving, sovereign, gracious God so everything can be as it ought to be. This is the gospel. Let's pray. God, thank you that you are a God of justice. Thank you that you don't just let sin slip by. God, thank you that you are oriented to what ought to be, and then you make provision out of your grace and your mercy toward us. We do not deserve that, but we just say thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for Christ. Thank you for his cross. Thank you for your undying love for us. In Jesus' name, everybody said amen. Let's stand and sing together.